Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Tuesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Charlie Cook of National Review is in for Jim Garrity today. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Three more martinis for you. Yesterday, we're not really sure we had a good one. Today, we probably have two good ones, actually, with a really horrible one wedged in between. Charlie, we don't start off with great news on the first one because it's tax day. That means everybody, if they haven't filed an extension, they got to get their income taxes filed. Hopefully, you're getting a refund. But in addition to the glum annual tradition of sending in federal income taxes, there's also some glimmers on the horizon. Major tax reform is always right there in the offing, but there seems to be a little bit more seriousness about it right now. Dave Camp, the outgoing chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, he's going to retire at the end of the year. He's kind of floated a proposal that didn't get very far. Folks on the left and right didn't really like it, but he's at least trying to make it simpler. Max Baucus had made noise about that before he left to become the ambassador of China. You've got other House conservatives today like Jack Kingston of Georgia, Tom Price of Georgia, openly urging Congress to adopt the fair tax, which is mainly a consumption tax. So, Charlie, it's good to see that Republicans aren't just out there grousing about the fact that it's tax day, although that's fun too sometimes, but actually putting forward ideas and hopefully with some specificity soon about how to actually make it simpler and hopefully less expensive for the taxpayers.
Well, it's always an opportunity, tax day, although it's less of an opportunity than it should be because of withholding. And conservatives are right when they say that if withholding were illegal, or rather weren't the policy, funnily enough, it's Milton Friedman, I think, before his days as a conservative hero who came up with the idea. But if withholding were not the way in which it worked, you'd have tax reform tomorrow. People would get to the end of the year and they'd say, sorry, I'm paying how much? Writing that check would be extra painful. So the fact that it's this painful with withholding is interesting in and of itself. It's been jumped on, funnily enough, by both sides, though. It's not just the tax reformers, such as myself, and the tax opponents, I should say, such as myself. But in the New Republic today, Jonathan Cohn wrote a piece saying that what we really need is to pay a lot more taxes. The only way that society is going to work properly is if the government gets to spend more, and he suggests that taxes are a very good deal, which is not a column you tend to see on April 15th, but at least he's honest. You know, tax reform is one of those perennial promises, and occasionally the tax code is cut down to size, but then over the course of 20, looks like it might even be 30 years in this case, it just grows and grows and grows, all the loopholes are added. It really is, I think, the time to cut it down.
Do you get the sense that there's any sort of grounds right now, given the culture and the politics in Washington, that there's going to be any common ground on this?
No, absolutely not. You have really two parties and two movements, at least in Washington, that are utterly opposed to one another philosophically, and that makes it extremely difficult for anything to be done. Now, it's somewhat silly that reform has been so elusive, given that even if you were to buy into the entire Democratic worldview or the entire progressive worldview, you still can't make the numbers add up. And this idea that we should raise taxes is fine in and of itself, and that's a reasonable argument, although one I violently disagree with. But we cannot pay for our level of spending, for example, with a tax increase. There's simply not enough money. This isn't, you know, 1998 anymore. We're not really living in good times. So, no, I don't think there's any chance of there being reform because of the differences philosophically. But the fact that there have been no changes to the status quo economically, apart from a very small tax increase on top earners, is worrying.
Last question on this topic for you, Charlie. What do you make of more and more folks on the right? Usually it used to be just kind of a libertarian or very conservative idea to embrace the fair tax, which is largely a national sales tax, but you scrap the federal income tax doing that. Given what you just said, it's probably not likely to happen, but what do you make of more and more folks on the right embracing that idea?
I would be happy to entertain the idea, providing that it were achieved via a constitutional amendment that simultaneously got rid of the income tax. I mean, there's absolutely no chance that I would support a fair tax national sales tax system while the federal government retained the capacity to tax incomes. Well, we know what would happen, and I know what happens from my own country, where there's a 20% VAT and extremely high income tax rate. Government will set the income tax rate at zero. It's a matter of policy. If fair tax were to go into play, then something would happen. Oh, well, we just needed a 5%. You remember, when the 16th Amendment was passed, there was a debate as to whether there should be a 5% cap on it in the amendment itself, and the framers said, don't be so ridiculous. The federal government's never going to take 5% income tax rates. So I'm open to the idea of providing it accompanies other income tax reform.
Yeah, I think a lot of folks would definitely make that part of the deal. That's one of the reasons why Herman Cain's 999 plan never caught on as much as he would have liked back when he was running for president. All right, on to the horrible story of the day. And unfortunately, we have seen instances like this before, although fortunately not super frequently. But police in Pleasant Grove, Utah, discovered over the weekend the bodies of seven dead infants in cardboard boxes in the garage of a woman named Megan Huntsman. She's 39 years old. She gave birth to the babies and then killed them over the past decade. And police apparently found these on her property on Saturday. Charlie, this obviously harkens back to the case probably more than a decade ago now of Andrea Yates drowning her six kids, I think it was, in the bathtub in Texas, and eventually getting a lighter sentence as a result of mental illness and so forth. But the idea that life could be treated like this and there isn't nearly as much outrage as you probably would have expected is kind of discouraging, to say the least.
Yes, these sorts of things have always happened throughout history, and bad things will continue to happen as long as men roam the earth. But my question would be, okay, so she killed her children after they were born. I think in this instance, the father didn't know about it because he was in prison for most of the time. I think he was shocked. But my question would be, well, okay, she killed them after they were born. What is the big difference between that and what your abortion extremists advocate for, which is essentially free abortion up to the point of birth? We have desensitized ourselves. We have convinced ourselves that young children and unborn children are not life and are not real and are not worthy of our respect and protection. And you have the likes of university professors, I forget which university it was, writing a paper suggesting that what this woman did should be legal because they have no agency of their own. I don't know where it ends.
It seems to be begging the question of that. I remember the Princeton ethicist, and I use that word very reservedly, Peter Singer, saying years ago that he thinks it should be up to 30 days or maybe even a couple of months before they're fully able to observe their surroundings and so forth. And then, yeah, the slippery slope just keeps getting slipperier from that point. Just amazing. All right, on to lighter fare and probably happy fare. It was just a couple of months ago, Charlie, that Democrats thought they were going to pick up a seat Republicans had held in the House of Representatives for decades, because Bill Young had held the seat for 42 years. He passed away in the fall. It's a district that was very, very competitive in the last couple presidential races. The Republicans nominated a guy named David Jolly, who had some personal issues. Alex Sink, who had almost been elected governor of Florida in 2010, was the Democrats' hopes of picking up this seat. In the end, it was a pretty close race, but she did not win, and now she is announcing that she is not even going to run in the rematch for the seat this November. So obviously the Democrats will come up with somebody else, and it'll be up to Jolly to make sure he's a effective representative for the district leading up to then. But the fact that the Democrats lost their best chance once again for this seat, pretty happy news for the GOP.
Yeah, I don't know how much that special election means for 2014. The general consensus is that special elections tell us about special elections and very little else. I do know, having read a lot of the reporting on the ground, that Obamacare did play into this, and it is going to continue to be a liability for the Democratic Party. But what this really is an amazing story of a fall from grace by Sink. You know, as she said, she almost became governor in 2010. They really thought they were going to pick up this seat. Then she almost beats him, and now she seems to have decided that it's not worth it. Now, I can't imagine that she's been offered something much better than being in the House of Representatives. She is a professional politician. And one can only surmise that she's looked at this race, she's looked at the dynamics, and she's decided that she can't win it and that she's not going to try. But as I say, I'm not sure that in and of itself, the fact that a Republican won that special election says too much. But if you add that to the decision from this morning, it's not looking bad for Republicans going into 2014.
No, certainly not, and we'll see what else happens in Florida. The Charlie Crist dynamic in that governor's race is really going to be fascinating. Do Democrats really just pretend that they didn't disagree with him vehemently for most of the time that he was governor? And
Well, he's another example of a fall from grace. If you look at the polling numbers with Rick Scott, I mean, Crist had a significant lead, and now he doesn't. Now he's losing. The firm that called the 2010 election to the closest degree has him 3 or 4 points down overall, 3 points down among Hispanics. I mean, these are not good numbers for Charlie Crist. And, you know, like the Sink case that we just discussed, you can't take this necessarily as a bellwether for the whole country. Nevertheless, it doesn't look good for Democrats. a lot of anecdotes like this, and you start to wonder.
Certainly the case, and there's a lot of other key races around the country we'll be following, and not only do they matter for 2014 and beyond, but which party controls the levers of government in some of these key battleground states for 2016 is pretty important as well, Florida being one of them. So
absolutely.
He's Charlie Cook of National Review, in for Jim Garrity. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We'll be back on Wednesday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.